Our next guest on the Alvan Talks podcast is Stephen Isaacs, a contrarian thinker, bold macro strategist, and somebody who doesn't play politics but believes in caveat emptor when it comes to markets and to life. I'm Ethan Devitt.
I'm Tom Raber.
And welcome to this Alvan Talks podcast, in which we chat with allocators and thinkers across the world of investment and bring them some Alvan level debate. We're joined today by Stephen Isaacs, strategic advisor to Alvan Capital, an angel investor who's held a number of roles as non-executive director and chair, and is a frequent commentator on macro and economic matters. Welcome, Stephen. Thanks for joining us here today.
Good morning.
Well, you're a macro expert, and we've seen you many times on CNBC and Bloomberg, and you're not afraid to have contrarian views. So let's just get straight into it. What are you thinking right now that you think might represent such a contrarian view? How are you seeing the current environment maybe a little different from the consensus?
Well, thank you for the flattery, Ethan. I mean, expert is a word that I'm always cautious about. I think it was Michael Gove who said in the run-up to the Brexit referendum that he was no truck with experts. So, I mean, I'm interested in markets, put it that way. I like talking about them. I like hearing other people's views. So I just like to sort of dial down my claim to too much expertise. Secondly, just to consider the word contrarian. I mean, that's a game. I was a trader. You know, I started my life as a bond trader at Credit Suisse, a name that one could just about remember. And yes, when you're a trader, you had to take positions and you had to think very carefully about how the market was positioned, how the people that you were trading essentially against, what they were doing, what they were thinking. But I think to be a successful investor, contrarian is perhaps too strong a word. I would rather just think about entry points, exit points, market positioning. In that context, think through whether or not you should be reweighting your portfolio, put it that way. So to answer your question, sorry for the rather long introductory monologue, I'm a little more cautious here. I mean, I think I did call fairly successfully in the autumn of 22 that markets had got oversold, that people were too aggressively bearish on the interest rate projection. And that has translated into a pretty substantial rally. The rally has really taken off since the beginning of October of last year, that is 23, we've had a 25% plus rally in a very, very steep straight line. Still going up again this week. And that makes me feel cautious. So I think if one's looking at entry level, if one's looking at reweighting your portfolio, I'm not convinced that today is a good entry level. If anything, I would be looking to ease back on risk. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, so just to sum up then on the macro, so you'd be a little concerned that things have got ahead of themselves. There was the Economist cover as we speak this week showing the market kind of going to infinity. So we hit three new highs on three continents. So just before passing back to Tom, what could it be that kind of bursts those balloons or does something to jeopardize this ascent?
I think it's a weight of overpositions, to be quite frank. I mean, I'm still comfortably on a long-term view. I mean, I'm not sort of trying to call a massive bear market here, but you asked the question. I mean, my year-end target for the S&P 500 was 5,100, and we're already there. You know, we got there inside 2 months. So I just think we're going to get some volatility from here. It could be geopolitical. I mean, if one's looking at black swan events, I think there are two things that concern me this year. One is a complete breakdown of the Ukrainian defensive position. I'm increasingly concerned. More and more desperate comments coming out of European capitals. So I think that could cause a shock in Europe, which would ripple through to markets. And secondly, I think just belief for service. I'm not convinced that OPEC, something could happen there. Angola's already left OPEC. I just have this horrible feeling that with US shale production hitting month-over-month highs, really, really crushing any attempt by OPEC to control prices. That's a kind of couple of black swan events. Very difficult to predict timing, but I think that's where possibly the trigger point could be for some turbulence. So we're not looking for a serious bear market, serious change in one's overall view that things are okay, but just to say, hang on a minute here, this is very, very overbought. and the markets ahead ready for some sort of volatility.
Okay, Stephen, I noticed that you didn't mention the presidential elections in the US. You don't think clearly they haven't factored into the rally at all. If anything, it's just completely ignored it. Do you think it's going to be a non-event? Who will be the new or the incumbent, or if President Trump comes back into office?
Well, I think it's interesting. One or two commenters have actually used the fact that they see a Trump presidency as on the horizon to justify part of the rally. In theory, he's more pro-business than Biden, although I think it's pretty marginal. I think, Tom, actually, there's not a lot to choose from between the two of them. If one's looking at markets and the economy, both of them are probably going to run huge fiscal deficits and a huge amount of spending. Perhaps Trump will be a bit more tax cut and Biden will be a bit more actually shoving money out the door. So I'm not that bothered about the politics. I mean, it's going to sound awful. There's going to be lawsuits, stuff flying around. I think they're after Hunter Biden at the moment. Obviously, Trump's got his numerous legal issues out there. So I think there'll be, you know, the odd day where there'll be some bombshell that might sound awful. But from an economic and markets point of view, I'm actually relatively neutral. I think Trump's going to win. I was in the States a few weeks ago. I was just to hear Ethan's point of view. And I think, assuming Biden doesn't drop out, then I think actually Trump will win. But I don't think it's that important to answer your question.
Okay. As we're talking about being an investor in the market, if you have not participated in the rally of 25% since October last year, and you're sitting there thinking, okay, what am I going to do now? Where would you put your money with a medium-term view?
I'm quite comfortable about the UK. I mean, we've also got elections here this year, Tom. I think it's pretty likely that Keir Starmer will become prime minister. And I think it's one of those kind of ironies that there's been quite a lot of press, you know, negativity about the UK, some of it deserved, I hasten to add, from the sort of mainstream media, from the FT, from Bloomberg. And I think somehow or another, Keir Starmer, there'll be a kind of attempt to recreate the sort of Blair bounce. And I think that we could have a couple of years of kind of reappraisal of the UK from at the moment. A pretty negative position. Valuations are at a huge discount, historically unprecedented discounts. So I think UK assets are pretty cheap. I also think there are pockets of real value in private markets. I mean, this private markets kind of held in 23, and people thought that was anomalous. 22 and 23, when public markets dropped back a lot. Now public markets have shot back up to record highs. I think there are more than pockets of value. I think there are good companies and good managers out there. I mean, the whole private equity game has changed. You know, you need operational skill set. You can't just rely on the tailwind and leverage. So there is going to be a greater dispersal of returns. But I think good managers in this environment are actually going to do well. I think there are some interesting opportunities there.
Okay, that's very interesting listening to you thinking about what to do in the market today. And as we know, the retail investor or the man on the street tends to always find the wrong entry or the right exit point, as it were. And the question is, of course, as a trader, how you, as an unemotional trader, avoid getting in at the wrong point and getting out at the wrong point, as it were. And my question to you is, what advice would you give somebody to be and how to become an unemotional investor?
Well, I'm not sure that anybody can be unemotional, Tom. I mean, I think you have to understand what your objectives are and what your risk profile is. In other words, what's your tolerance to pain and what you're trying to achieve. So it's a difficult question to answer. People ask me that question. I don't know why. Where would you put your money, Stephen? You're a man who's worked in finance for 40 years. And I always ask them back the question, which is, what are you trying to achieve? What's your risk profile? So until you know those two questions, it's very difficult to answer them. But I think I'll try to make a general comment. And I think, generally speaking, the old argument about spreading your entry level is definitely true. So rather than putting everything in at one go, let's just say you like the UK, you're prepared to tolerate my view on this, then just make sure you don't allocate everything at one go. Come in on a monthly basis, spread your entry level. That's got to be good advice. And secondly, I think the issue of being unemotional probably best reflects when people panic and sell. And I think one way of not doing that is don't look at your portfolio all the time. I mean, I've taken my portfolio off. I used to have an app with my main portfolio. I could see it every day. I actually took it off my phone and tablet. So if I want to see my portfolio now, I have to actually email my private banker and he sends it across to me. And that's a kind of rather crude way, but it's a filter of saying, don't micromanage and don't look at the numbers all the time, because often that will bounce you into making a poor decision.
And just to follow up on that, you were talking about your private advisor, as it were, a private banker, Stephen. So would you then advocate that having an intermediary is actually a good thing, regardless of where you are? If you're a small private investor, you're a large institution, leave it to the professional. They are unemotional. They can have it on their screen. You don't need to have it on your screen. And then you can do and live your life normally. You sleep well at night. Is that a better way of handling? Give the instructions early in the year. This is the asset allocation. This is what we're trying to achieve. And then almost, as it were, forget about it.
I think there's some truth in that, Tom. I do actually manage my own portfolio. So having the private banker there was more just a kind of filter for me to be not looking at the portfolio all the time. It's a rather odd, obtuse way of doing it, but it actually works for me. I'm not sure about that, Tom. I mean, it's difficult to get good advice these days. It's difficult to find people that actually understand what you're trying to do. And I haven't found that. So I'm not sure about that. I think information is available. I think people can actually take a quite active role in investing. I just think that what they need to do is understand what the risk tolerance is, invest slowly, and then don't micromanage. Maybe those are the ways of putting it.
Yeah.
I love that, Stephen. And I'm kind of like, I'm thinking it's almost the equivalent of having no chocolates and candies in the house, and then you won't do something that you know is not good for you. You locking up your portfolio with your private banker and not letting yourself access it. And I just wanted to bring in on the US election point. You did ask for my view. I would note that you did spend that time in Florida when you were in the US, which can sometimes affect sentiments that the state one's in. It's so polarized. But I suppose the one point I'd throw out there, which could be a reason for the incumbent prevailing and not the challenger, is around the lack of a recession and this, you know, ongoing resilience of the US economy, strong employment picture, strong consumer. Usually when that's the case, even if approval ratings are low and even below 50%, usually that is a good thing for the incumbent. We don't know. But, you know, your position is noted, and let's all we can do is wait and see as the year approaches. So just in terms of the backing up a little bit, because we talked about expert status or how we define that and your macro view, can you just walk us briefly through the career you had before this to kind of form those macro views and the kind of insights that it gave you?
Well, I started my career at Credit Suisse actually with Tom, which I'm very pleased to have had such a long friendship and business relationship with him more recently. And on the first day, they took one look at me and said, oh, you're a trader. And they sort of go over there and pick up the phone. It was a little bit of a different world, Ethan. There wasn't exactly a great deal of training, but I was lucky enough to work with some interesting people, in particular, a mentor of mine who I'm still in touch with. He was kind enough to explain to me what hedge funds are. People talking about this morning meeting, hedge funds rate, no idea what he was talking about. So, you know, that kind of drew me in and I stayed in trading for around 10 years, doing all sorts of different things, trading generally fixed income, but different types of fixed income. And the bond market is, again, in those days, people were afraid of the bond market. We had the bond market vigilantes. The numbers in the bond market, the size of the issuance, the size of the secondary market was and still is, dwarfed the equity market. So, you know, we were told, I think there's something in this, that the bond market kind of sees something. It's often actually ahead of the game, whereas the equity market can be more influenced by things like retail flows and momentum. So that's kind of where I look, Ethan. I mean, you know, the interrelation between politics, markets, and economics, those three prisms, how do they fit? How do they overlap? That's, to me, a jigsaw that I'm profoundly interested in, to be quite frank. So I like reading the FT every day. I think, although I don't like their political coverage, to be quite frank, there's always something in the FT that you see. Every day, there's an article buried somewhere that tells you something, informs you something. So you have to be curious. You have to have an open mind. And back to the opening preamble about being an expert, I don't know whether I'm an expert or not, but I like learning, like hearing about new things. And markets are changing. I mean, you know, artificial intelligence is something totally new. A few years ago, no one ever heard of it. Now it's dominating investors' thinking. So you need to be on top of the ball, even if you are kind of a little bit long in the tooth, as an impression really. This is fortunately, hopefully, not going to be with pictures. So that's what you have to do. You have to challenge yourself. You have to read and you have to think about the next thing. I've done that for 40 years and I'm going to carry on doing it, I hope. I think I'll be reading the FT probably on my deathbed. So there's a plug for that esteemed newspaper.
Talking about reading the FT, we've shared offices both in the early part of our careers and now in the later part of our careers. I've been urging the younger generation to read the FT. And when I come in a bit late, occasionally it's usually not read. That concerns me. And then they tell me, well, they've read it already on the phone on the way in, which I'm not sure they have. Do you think the new generation are not kind of approaching the markets the same way we are? And is that something that we should be concerned about?
That's a good question, Tom. I think there's too much information. And all of us are being blinded by webcasts, newspapers, podcasts, you know, financial TV, you know, you name it. And therefore, it's quite easy to switch off and just say, yeah, I know what's going on. And you're not delving and not thinking. So I think you're probably right. I do tease some of our colleagues when I pick up on something. And I said, did you read the FT at the weekend? Yeah, I read it. And I'm sure they may have skimmed through it. They didn't find the article that's actually relevant to us. I mean, there are lots of other articles that are interesting, but don't necessarily impact our business. But there was one, there it was. And I don't find our colleagues and younger people actually often picking up on that. So I think there's too much information and that allows you to be lazy and just say, yeah, I know what's going on. And the answer is you do on a very superficial level, but you're not challenging yourself, you're not thinking. And I think we all need to do that.
Yeah. And does that also mean that the younger people that are coming into financial markets need to be investors themselves? Is that because otherwise it becomes an abstract game? You're walking into, this is maybe a bad analogy, but the casino, and everybody's playing on the tables, but you haven't got any chips on the table yourself, so therefore you're not engaged. Is that an issue possibly?
I think it's a very good question, Tom. I mean, I wouldn't just say about young people, by the way. I think all of us, I think the criticism generally about not thinking probably shouldn't be exclusively directed at the young people. I think the compliance industry has again circumvented a lot of that capacity to actually have your own money in the game and be an investor and hence to feel it. And I agree with you. I think it's a very good point. I've always encouraged it. You know, when we were working for a blue chip mainstream bank, it was completely allowable. Now, because of conflicts of interest and, you know, all sorts of compliance issues, it's become pretty difficult. And although I appreciate that there are issues that need to be thought through, I think it's very important that people do invest and do therefore sometimes feel the pain when things go wrong. Because again, when our clients lose money, which obviously happens very rarely, then it's important that we who are engaging with those clients actually understand why that they are, let's say, disappointed, to put it mildly.
And I suppose the other thing on the next generation, time horizon. I mean, time horizon, clearly, if you're able to not look at your portfolio, you're increasingly building in a time horizon that is long term. And I would think the younger generation with shorts, just with the gratification, and we can see things like Bitcoin, which have popped quite significantly in and up and down in a short time horizon. That could be another difference, perhaps, but this new generation. Yeah, speaking of Bitcoin, in views on digital assets, love to know where you fall on the consensus spectrum there.
I absolutely hate them, Ethan. I mean, I did write one of my last newsletters, which I think is probably one of my better ones. I think I call it a Bitcoin too far. I mean, look, we are in a world, not for the first time, where there are question marks about fiat money. And for sure, the first Chinese banknote, first paper banknote, 75 years after it had been printed, it wasn't worth the paper it was written on. So all of us are concerned about, rightly so, about where are we going with fiat money. But digital assets, I really don't like. I'm concerned particularly that there'll be regulation suddenly appearing over the weekend, that there'll be a withholding tax or some other pernicious regulation that will completely upend the game. But otherwise, there's issues about potentially being use of money laundering. I'm afraid it's not for me. I think there's one Swiss private bank who's actually kind of banned the private bankers are even mentioning the words. I'm afraid I'm with them on that.
I suppose looking at some asset allocation broadly, and this may have the form of quick fire, and Tom and I may interject and take fire alternating, but in explicit, that's backing up a little bit and looking at other assets. Looking at big picture, we have seen quite a difference in terms of the behavior, say bonds and equities, being more highly correlated to each other than they would have been recently in the past, say in the past, when they would have been a hedge against each other. Does that concern you? Do you think that maybe we need to rethink asset allocation somewhat?
It's a very good question. I mean, you're right. Absolutely. You know, bonds and equities, sometimes they are completely correlated. Sometimes they are completely uncorrelated. And that is driven by where we are in the economic cycle. So if you go into a financial crisis, stroke, savage recession, then interest rates are slashed, and that would benefit quality bonds and not necessarily equities. We're not in that cycle, to follow on your point about where is the US economy going. I actually think the US economy is going to continue to perform reasonably well. I do want to plug credit, actually, for changing the subject a bit. So if you are looking at putting a portfolio together now, the credit, which was out of favor for a very clear reason, that it didn't quite provide much return at all when we had essentially 0% interest rates for 15 years. I think there's a lot of value in credit. And I think most portfolios can benefit from some distributable coupons. And credit now, with not a great deal of imagination, can get you double digit, which isn't too bad. So that's possibly where I'd be building value today when I'm a bit more cautious about building equity positions.
I do agree with you. I just wanted to ask if you could expand on it a little bit to talk about either private credit or liquid credit, in the sense that the private credit markets obviously means that you lock up your money for a few years at least, and some of them have drawdown structures which some investors may or may not like. So I wanted to ask you on the liquid versus private credit, and particularly on the liquid credit side, what type of ideas do you have there? It's not so easy to access for some investors. And if you have any suggestions for our listeners?
It depends on your own liquidity profile before I can definitively answer that question, Tom. But I think there's an awful lot of investors, I'm sure, where Ethan sits now with their new job, who are kind of demanding liquidity when they actually don't need it. And actually, there isn't much liquidity. So even in so-called mainstream markets, if there's a crisis, if you need something, you'll often find that the asset that you thought was liquid, that was advertised, that was sold to you as liquid, isn't actually that liquid, or there's quite a big penalty, or it's a fast market. So I think that taking that liquidity premium from closed-end funds, from lockup funds, is sensible unless you really need liquidity, which, as I said, most people don't. So that's the first point. And I think for the manager, for the people actually deploying capital, I think it is a huge advantage, and they're able to get better returns, is that they know they've got capital. They can do better research. They can hire more staff, more credit managers, that sort of thing, within a structure of a credit shop, rather than worrying that tomorrow there could be a change in the market, suddenly they lose all their assets. So I think it's a better business. Now, again, from the borrower's side, because of changes in regulation, there is a limited amount of what used to be traditional bank capital available for borrowers. And that's created a lovely symbiosis that actually borrowers need and are prepared to pay more juicy, more interesting returns for us investors. So I like private credit. I mean, there'll be scandals. We haven't really seen one yet. We haven't really seen a big blow up. It's got to come somewhere because there's literally so much money that's been put into private credit. And hence, one has to kind of do one's own homework and realize that there will be the odd scandal out there. But I don't think too many. And I think actually private credit should be part of most portfolios.
Can I ask a follow-up question, which is somewhat related to credit? We work together at Alvine Capital on various alternatives, for lack of a better definition. So life settlement funds, music royalty funds, litigation funds. Where are they at the moment? And is that something one should look at in 2024?
I think they were largely a product of the zero rate interest rate environment. I'm not convinced that they have repriced sufficiently. I mean, there's nothing wrong with saying that. I remember one pension fund manager saying to me they want to own a slice of the economy. So if I have credit card receivables or music royalties or something like that, then I'm just getting some of that return in a different way. And sometimes they can be less volatile because you don't have a market maker and you don't have the pressures of other investors necessarily trading them. But I'm concerned that the return profile, which might have been, say, high single digits in a zero rate environment, has not fully adjusted yet. So if I can get 15 to 20% from a pure alternative, if you like, then that seems to me a reasonable return, but it's got to be a proper margin above traditional credit. And I'm not quite convinced it's there yet.
Building on that, the private credit, and I completely agree with you regarding its role and the place it has in portfolios. How about this undercurrent of trouble we're seeing in the US around commercial real estate and how that has been having the potential to really undermine some of the credit worthiness of many banks and certainly leading them to take big write-downs? Do you see that? I mean, that's more than a canary in the coal mine at this point. It's kind of a red flashing light. Certainly for some areas. We've seen it in Canary Wharf. We've seen it in the Midtown Manhattan office. And real estate in general has been quite uncertain and beaten down. Thoughts for that asset class?
Yeah, I'm a bit more relaxed about it, Ethan. I mean, COVID, extraordinary era. We look back, we can't really believe it. It happened. Sort of bad dream. But I think life goes on. And, you know, I've been in the States, I've been in New York, I've been in Boston, I've been in Florida recently, obviously I work in London. You don't get the feeling, actually, that everybody's lives have changed quite as much as perhaps we thought they would. So I think it's coming back a bit. I mean, I sat next to somebody very interesting a few months ago at a conference, and they said they'd come up with some sort of model about which parts of the real estate market, commercial real estate market, are going to be affected the most. And they said it's got something to do with this. It's sort of size of people's homes and commutability. So if you live in Paris and you've got a small bijou apartment and you can go five stops on the metro to your office, you're going to do it. If you live in Los Angeles and you live in a 5,000 square foot house and you've got an hour and a half commute, you're not going to bother. So there's quite a lot of detail out there. But I think it will be restructured. Again, you know, there's a pressing demand for more housing everywhere. You know, cities, neighborhoods get reinvented. I'm not quite as worried about it, I think, as the market is.
Got it. Moving to another asset class now, which is emerging, certainly, and still probably untested, unproven. The whole area of sustainability, whether it be ESG integration across normal funds or labeled funds around the Paris aligned or in various explicitly nature-based solutions. What are your thoughts on that emerging set of assets?
Well, I think it's plant-driven. I mean, there's no question that particularly in Europe, particularly in Northern Europe, investors had a very different viewpoint to where even a few years ago as to what they're looking for. And the market is obliging. So it's a niche. It's very important for some people. I think it's amazing that, you know, Wall Street and City of London and other clever people have come up with solutions, as they will always will do. So I think it makes the industry more interesting. So, I mean, you know, talking to younger people, why should you come into financial services? When Tom and I came into financial services, it was kind of bonds and equities, and that was it. We found it interesting. I still find it interesting, but it wasn't necessary for everybody. Now, if you talk to young people and you say, would you consider a career in financial services? Some of them might have been traditionally put off because they felt it was selling their soul to mammon. Now we can say, well, hang on a minute here. Actually, there is impact investing. We are actually taking wind farms and securitizing them and so on and so forth. So I think it's actually attracting a higher quality and a more diverse group of young people to the industry. And I think that's very positive.
Yeah, no, so Stephen, that's very insightful. And thank you for giving us all this perspective on the markets. One asset class we haven't talked about is the insurance area and the cat bonds and the various other. They were, for a little while, it seemed like very much in vogue. Then they had a hiccup a few years ago. And my view is that they have actually been repriced, unlike maybe some of the other alternatives we talked about. Do you have a view on that segment of the market?
Well, I think if it's been repriced, Tom, then I think it's another source of revenue. And I think the advantage of insurance-linked securities, particularly cat bonds, is that they are genuinely uncorrelated. There is no question that if there's a financial crisis tomorrow, the Fed hikes rates and the S&P 500 drops 15%, then it won't affect the pricing of cat bonds. Whereas an awful lot of other stuff that was kind of packaged up as uncorrelated, particularly, say, hedge funds, people found to their cost that there was more correlation than they thought there was. So it's an expertise, Tom. You know, you need to find the right manager. You need to really get right in there and see what their underwriting is. But there are some good managers in the area. So, you know, it can have a small part in your portfolio if that yield is paying you enough. And to me, that would need to be really north of 12, probably north of 15% today.
Right. I believe cat bonds that you can buy in a UCITS format are priced today at cash plus 8.5%. So that seems to me to be a very interesting place to put your money with some good liquidity at this point in time.
That sounds like a sufficient risk-reward return. Yes, I would agree with that.
Question, Stephen. One of the areas that concerns me a lot right now is governance and the lack of proper governance in areas that are growing in complexity. And I think we mentioned this a little bit just around things like digital assets and some of the other areas where we are adding on these layers of complexity, and climate metrics too are complex. I think often there's a desire not to engage when it comes to complexity, and governance is not working well. You've had a number of board positions, and I'd love to just hear your thoughts on what's an effective board member and whether you share any of my concerns that we're actually getting less good at challenging some of these complex instruments.
Well, I think investors have to remember caveat emptor. And, you know, I'm concerned more generally. One of the things that's gone wrong in this country is regulation on regulation, which has kind of driven away the concept of risk. So I'm always worried about more and more government, if you really want my honest view, particularly legislatively. I think the composition of the board and how they interact is the most important thing. And how do you create that right metric? It's a very difficult question. It's down to the chair. It's down to the CEO who put that board together. They need to be able to be challenged. And unfortunately, many people that run businesses, run funds, don't want it. They want to surround themselves with their friends or with notional diversity. So they can choose diversity in other metrics, but they refuse to have it in people's real experience and ability to ask questions. It's a very difficult question, Ethan. I don't know how you get it right. I have been on one board where I thought we really got it right, if I may say so, where we really gelled and we were able to challenge each other and the business. I did extremely well, partly perhaps because of the quality of the board. But I've been on others where it's not worked really. And I actually absented myself because I felt it was not a good use of my time. So I like that. And I think it should be something, it should be down to the chair, the CEO, and they need to ask themselves, what is the purpose of this board? You know, is it there to make me feel good, or is it there to actually make the business better?
Yeah, no, I wanted to have a follow-up question there, because when you deal with mavericks in hedge funds, in private markets, these firms tend to be created by, founded by some very strong people. And they, as you say, they bring in their chums. The board is really there more as a figurative board, doesn't really do the functions particularly well. Every important question and decision comes back to the founder. And that often, when things really go wrong, then there is no governance. And also, of course, many of these companies are offshore structures. They're not regulated, really. They have a regulated entity that's at the end of some sort of a structure. But at the end of the day, it's too late to do something. And that's a concern that we've had for a long time. And it's very important, of course, to do your due diligence. And very often, it's up to the founder to make sure that in such events, you know, what's the board really there for? And how do we avoid that in the future? Do you think there will be changes?
It's a good point, Tom. I think the answer is that you can't. I mean, you kind of make a decision that I'm going to back X and I'm just going to go with X. And that person, generally a he, is going to go and make me some money and I'm going to ride the tiger and hope I get out, because eventually it won't work, because all these kind of maverick great founder managers have a limited shelf life. They get too wealthy, they lose their edge, the market changes, and then it's over. And you've either ridden the tiger successfully and got out, or, as you said, Tom, when it does go wrong, you probably get embroiled in something which is difficult, more clumsy to get out. I don't think you can do due diligence in that situation, because, as you said, the board might look good. It might even have some luminaries on there who are notionally there to provide ballast. But at the end of the day, you know that the charismatic founder is the person that's calling the shots. So you either do that trade and you say, I'm taking the risk and I really believe in this person, that there's enough upside, or you say, that's not for me. For most people, it shouldn't be part of their investment style at all.
That is a concern, of course. If I may just say one more thing about that, I mean, you can see that also at multinational companies. I mean, you have a situation with Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, or these individuals all of a sudden are more important than heads of state, you know? And so it's not just at smaller companies.
Yeah, some companies are able to develop, like Microsoft, way beyond the founders, institutionalize themselves and become great businesses. Apple, for example. Others don't and can't. The jury's out on Elon Musk. I mean, he's obviously a brilliant man. He's the mover and shaker of this generation. Can he institutionalize Tesla and turn it into a leading car making business for the next 10 years? I'm doubtful, but I don't know.
Stephen, looking back your personal journey, ups and downs, just like markets, I'm sure. Any particular lessons you learned in there in the professional side of things, whether it relates to investing, governance, approaching the world of work?
Yeah, I mean, two lessons I've probably learned. One is that you should generally be invested, and that trying to time markets is very difficult and generally a folly. You know, somehow or another, humans will find a way of debasing money. Whether it's the Romans or whether it's the Chinese or whether it's us, just kind of go with the flow. Second lesson I learned, well, personally, is about politics, internal politics. I've not been very good at it. I've tended to kind of stick my hand up and give my opinion. I think I've been right, mostly. People don't like it. So if you want a successful career in financial services, probably any industry, learn to be very muted in the way that you express yourself, and I'm not being very good at it. I'm trying to do better, Tom.
Okay, well, that's very good, Stephen. Can I just ask you about that? Because I think it is an important thing when it comes to careers within financial services for young people. One of the concerns I had, even, you know, at the bigger, very, very well-known brand names, there is really no career path. I mean, you come into these big firms and you think they're going to have a career for you. Well, that's not true. They train you up, they put you in a place, and then you work as hard as you can. And there's very seldom anyone thinking of what is your career. So you've got to think about it yourself. Is that something you would agree with?
I do, Tom. But it's never been a proper career. I mean, if you went into law or medicine or something like that, you know, you kind of move up the food chain, you get qualified, you build a practice, and you have a career. We never had that. Over 40 years, actually, even 40 years ago, even less so today. But I think that's actually the way of the world. I think younger people actually understand that now. Almost anywhere they go, unless they take a really real vocation, I think people do understand that. But how do you build your career if you're starting out now? I think you need to be a networker. I think you need to understand that there will be a need or a time when you want to move on. And just knocking on the front door, sending your CV, something like that, maybe that works sometimes, but a lot of the time it won't. It will be through personal connections. And again, I think young people need to understand that. You and I know that. And I think it's also fun to meet people and to hear about what they're doing in other firms, other parts of industry. I think you're back. You're also learning. But I think for your career, it's fine.
I think it's a really interesting point you make about muting one's opinions, because obviously there's a balance there. I mean, I'm trying to coach my daughters entering this profession in a few years, but you do have to develop a strong sense of values and a core sense of values that you hold true, that I suppose that you know where you stand, that you're not neutral when it comes to values. So it's an interesting balance, and there will be trial and error, but I think it's a good point that you make. One cannot be ignorant as to the politics, and it is ultimately about people.
That I do think that all of us should do, young, old, whatever, is, you know, professionalism. What does that mean? You know, I think being very clear that you do what you say you're going to do, deliver reports on time, that you engage with people, you know, listen to them. So, you know, professionalism is absolutely essential. It's not that difficult to do. It just requires a bit of thoroughness. And the second one is actually integrity or honesty, that there are times sometimes when you can cut a corner, you can pick something up from somebody, and you kind of know it's not quite right. That can ruin your career, even more so than when Tom and I started. You know, there is no latitude any longer for slippage in that department, nor should they be. So, you know, careers have been ruined where people haven't basically bought the right train fare. They've done something silly like that. Quite wealthy people have been caught in that one. So again, professionalism and integrity are absolutely vital.
Any heroes of yours in the professional world? Anyone who you saw said, okay, that person has changed how I think, or it's I'll never see the world the same way again after interacting or watching that person in action?
Well, I think undoubtedly Warren Buffett. I mean, you know, an incredible man who has built a business and has understood about good companies and about patience and about not selling. There you go, very rarely selling. So I think Warren Buffett is undoubtedly my hero. I mean, I was lucky enough to work at Credit Suisse with a guy called Ozzie Grubel, who's a great trader, head of trading, and he got me thinking about certain things, about, say, ratings. I remember, you know, this is, you know, talking about in the early 90s, well before people picked up on how toxic mortgage securities could be. But I came to him with a bond, and it was AAA rated. And he just sat me down and said, look, Stephen, how can this bond be AAA? And I said, oh, yeah, it's being securitized. I said, no. This cannot be AAA. You know, the Kingdom of Sweden, that's AAA. So things like that really made me think. So Ozzie Grubel, my personal hero, Warren Buffett is my kind of industry hero.
And if you were, Stephen, in the movies, which movie would you star in and what would be your role in it?
Well, obviously, I'd be Gordon Gekko, because I'd love to wear the braces or suspenders, as the Americans call it, slick my hair back, and smoke a cigar and have fun. Both of the films, the first one and Money Never Sleeps, are two films for people who've worked in this industry that are great fun. Obviously, they're the fiction, work of fiction, and Gordon Gekko obviously got caught at the end. But I'd like it to be Gordon Gekko. Sorry to be there.
No, I think that suits you very well. And you look a bit like Michael Douglas as well. So you would fit in very well. Stephen, how does one end, if that's the word, a career in financial services, if that's what you do?
Well, they end it for you, Tom. So, you know, I mean, this isn't a career in the traditional sense. So there comes a time, and most of our contemporaries, as we know, are not working, to be honest. So it can be a little bit on the short side that people in their 50s, a lot of them, generally, it comes to an end. I mean, I don't know. You make yourself useful. I think you reinvent yourself. You stay current so that people actually ask you and they know that you know what's going on just because you've got a few gray hairs. But, you know, all good things come to an end. That's life. I mean, you know, you can't be nostalgic or wistful. Stuff happens and careers, all careers come to an end. Financial services, probably a bit more abruptly than most. Hopefully you get a payoff.
Unless you're Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger, both of whom, until Charlie died, going strong in their 90s. So, and since you said you'll be reading the Financial Times on your deathbed, I guess there'll be an ongoing interest and participation for you. I'm going to sneak in one last question, just because I'm sure you have something for us. This is, we usually ask about kind of word of wisdom, creed or motto, or something that, you know, just a gem expression, anything that you think is defines you, or you can, we would all be good to adhere to.
Well, probably caveat emptor. I mean, you know, don't rely on somebody's due diligence or a piece of paper or a rating or a fad. Just ask yourself what your risk tolerance is. Ask yourself, do you really understand what you're investing in? And if you don't understand, either become better informed and ask for advice or don't do it. So I'd say caveat emptor is probably my favorite expression. I like Latin expressions.
Thank you, Stephen. It has been just as illuminating as I expected to hear your insights on markets. It is never dull to chat with you. And thank you for injecting your curious sense of inquiry into everything you do and for making the industry a more interesting place to work in.
Yeah, and I'd like to echo that and say thank you on behalf of myself and everyone at Alvine Capital. Thank you for taking part in this podcast. And I have to say, Stephen, I mean, he is a very interesting guy, and lots of the things that he said are incredibly relevant. I'm so glad he spoke so openly and insightfully, and of course, without really, it seemed, having to rehearse anything. It was just right there. I mean, and I think that's what happens when you are a trader. It's right there. You know, it's, you've got all these things in your head, but you also know how to pull the trigger in 1 second, and that's what makes Stephen Isaacs, in my view, a very unique person in the markets.
Stephen always keeps it real. He knows who he is. He's authentic. He doesn't play politics, as he noted. Maybe that's why he has not always had outcomes he wanted. But I think he's very self-aware. And he's not afraid to hold bold opinions. And that's a very refreshing thing to encounter in our space, when often things get watered down or personalities become bland. So thank you for introducing me to him. And as I said, he always keeps us on our toes.
That's right. And the other thing we mustn't forget is he has got some of the contrarian calls completely right when they were completely out of vogue. So I can mention two. One, of course, being the Brexit vote. And the second was Trump being elected. And when he last year called the markets, this is the time to put some money to work, and they've gone up 25%. So lots of people can do a lot of talk, but it may not actually be some substance behind it. Whereas when it comes to Stephen Isaacs, there's a lot of substance.
I'm Ethan Devitt.
And I'm Tom Raber.
Thank you for listening to our Alvine Talks podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring professionals and their journeys, you can hear us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.